one of the important and interesting theological purposes that Lewis has in mind for this planetary symbolism. He's wanting to take each planetary symbol and use it to bring out a different aspect of God's nature.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, the producer of the show, along with being a co-host today. For this episode, I'm combining the re-release of a series on the Narnia Code that was recorded first in 2012. Dr. Holly Ordway helped with co-hosting duties for that series. This is the second repackaged show. The first combined the initial three podcasts, and this joins the fourth and fifth episodes. If you haven't listened to the previous re-release, then be sure to check the show notes for a link to listen to it to gain the greatest understanding of Dr. Ward's approach. As noted in the other show, while I had Michael and Holly talking with me via Skype, I had a different setup then and wasn't able to record at a better quality than what you hear in more recent recorded shows. While you should have no problem hearing the discussion, I still wish the quality was even better. Again, for this episode, you'll hear two shows which will be separated by a brief musical transition, and the material will be dealing with the fourth and fifth chapter from the Narnia Code. They focused on the first two published books, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and Prince Caspian.
So this is episode four, and in it we will be looking at The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and the themes in it. Well, in the first three episodes, we talked a little bit about the mystery, about the idea that Lewis could actually hide something as important as an entire literary code in these books. So make sure you catch up on those episodes. But one of the things that we can note about this is that Lewis himself commented in his own writing that good art hides itself, referencing Ovid, a poet whom he admired. And he noted also that we should not believe everything that authors say about their own works. He's actually quite clear about that. And so even though in the essay, sometimes fairy stories may say thus what's to be said, he says, oh, the whole Chronicles of Narnia and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it all began with a picture. He then goes on from there, but he, in starting with it all began with a picture, sidesteps the question of the significance of that picture in the first place. So with that, I want to hand it over to Michael to elaborate.
Yes, he says that The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the first of the seven Chronicles, all began with a picture. A picture of a faun in a snowy wood carrying parcels and an umbrella. And he says that this picture had been in his mind's eye since he was about 16. And then one day when he was about 50, he said, let's make a story about it. And he said that the composition process for him generally began with seeing pictures in his head. It was a little bit like bird watching, he said. He just keeps watching these pictures and gradually one picture leads to another and they link up and make a story, and often without very much forcing or filling in of the gaps, a story presents itself almost ready-made to his imagination. But the thing that he doesn't explain is why this picture of the faun in the snowy wood carrying parcels and an umbrella, why it was important to him, why he thought it was worth turning into a story. And that's, I think, the question which is really worth asking. Why? What was it about this picture that made it so special? And I think that when you are properly acquainted with C.S. Lewis's imagination and you see how snow and Christmas, or winter and Christmas, had particular associations for him, then this understanding of the Narnia Chronicles as related to the planets becomes a little bit more explicable. Because almost every time Lewis talks about winter, it's as a bad thing. Summer is good, winter is bad, generally, in C.S. Lewis's imagination. Not always, but generally. And winter was a particular quality of Saturn, the worst of the planets, the planet of old age and death and coldness. Whereas Christmas, in his imagination, tends to be associated with Jupiter, the best of the planets, the festive, magnanimous, prosperous planet, a symbol of all these good qualities. So think back to that picture of the faun in the snowy wood carrying parcels. You've got a snowy wood. But this isn't a good snowy wood. This isn't a happy winter. This is a snowy wood that the faun is trying to protect himself against with the umbrella. He's not larking about throwing snowballs and building snowmen. He's protecting himself against it, which would indicate that it's a bad kind of winter, a saturnine kind of winter. And indeed, that's what the winter turns out to be once the story gets going. It's an accursed winter. It's a 100-year winter that the White Witch has laid over the country of Narnia as a kind of tyranny. On the other hand, the Fawn is carrying parcels. We're not told explicitly that they're Christmas parcels, but that's the suggestion, that's the implication, because the Fawn, in the developed story, laments that it's always winter but never Christmas. It's as if he's bought these parcels and can't unwrap them. He's, you know, stockpiling endless amounts of Christmas gifts and never able to unwrap them. So there, if that reading is right, there you have a clash of two planets, Saturn and Jupiter, which is going to win out. In 1935, 15 years before he wrote The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, Lewis said that of Saturn we know more than enough, but who does not need to be reminded of Jove? Jove is Jupiter by another name. He thought that much of the culture of the 1920s and 30s was Saturnocentric, as he said, fixated upon death, disaster, cynicism, pessimism, all these bad qualities associated with Saturn. And that was a very natural result of the great calamity that Western culture had been through in the Great War, which naturally disposed people to think in Saturnine ways. But he thought that was an accident. It wasn't an eternal truth about the nature of the universe. And a much better way of symbolizing the heart of spiritual reality was through the symbolism of Jove or Jupiter, the king, the sovereign, the wise, tranquil, magnanimous sovereign of the seven heavens. Jupiter's symbolism was, for Lewis, a much better way of symbolizing the Christian God.
Now, I remember in your book here you mentioned that Mr. Tumnus had a longing for the olden days of, and Lewis uses the word, jollification, and you note that that's a very important word.
That's right, jollification. Well, what a great word. I remember when I was a kid reading the book and thinking, jollification. Yes, I'd like some of that. And you hear the Fawn's lament for those lost days when there would be dancing and festivity and happiness, and all those things have been done away with in this 100-year winter. But jollification, yes, I mean, that's almost an encapsulation in a single word of the spirit of Jupiter, as I say, who's festive and prosperous and associated with halcyon days and serenity. And Father Christmas is a kind of personification of that in one central figure.
Now, one of the interesting things from looking at Lewis's work overall is that he has, in a sense, tested out or worked with the idea of the planets before, and in the Ransom trilogy, notably. And so in That Hideous Strength in particular, we do get the characteristics of Jupiter on display along with the other planets. So when we come to the Chronicles of Narnia, it's not as if he's coming out of completely nowhere with this planetary symbolism, leading us to be very skeptical. But in fact, we see him using it already in his earlier novels.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, he's been familiarizing himself with this planetary symbolism from early childhood, actually. The very first poem that Lewis ever wrote that was published in his school magazine when he was 10 or 12 was a poem, incidentally, about a clash between Saturn and Jupiter. And as Lewis grew up and became steadily more and more acquainted with the literature of Christian Europe, he saw how Jupiter was used all over the place by writers like Dante and Chaucer and Spenser and Milton as a symbol of good things. And Lewis gradually, as his writing career progressed, began to use that symbolic system, this sevenfold spectrum of these planetary symbols, more and more as his kind of controlling symbol system, really. And you find it all over his poetry, and very explicitly used, as you say, Holly, in the Ransom trilogy.
Now, one of the other things you note in your book, The Narnia Code, is how kingship is the key to the plot of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes, well, it's the key to the plot, and it's also the key to the portrayal of Aslan's character. The story is really a clash of kingship between Peter and Edmund. Who's going to become king of Narnia? The witch has ensnared Edmund with her promise that She wants a boy who will be king of Narnia after she's gone. Everybody tends to remember the Turkish delight, because that's what appeals to a young audience and anybody with a sweet tooth. We remember that that Edmund is kind of entrapped with the Turkish delight, but actually that's just the bait on the hook. The thing that reels him in is the prospect of becoming king. That's what he wants to happen, so that he can pay Peter back for calling him a beast. He thinks about becoming a king of Narnia, he thinks about making roads when he's king of Narnia, and the witch is constantly dangling in front of him this prospect that he's the prince and later on he's going to be the king. That's his ambition, not to eat more and more Turkish delight. The Turkish delight is just a byproduct, a kind of, you know, a side dish, as it were. The main meal is that he's going to become the king and be in charge, no longer have to submit to Peter or that awful Aslan, as he calls him. Peter, on the other hand, is taken by Aslan and he's shown the four thrones at Caer Paravel. And Aslan says to Peter, you must sit in these, in one of these thrones and you will be high king over all the rest. So that's the basic plot clash between Peter and Edmund. Who's going to become king and how? And of course, how it happens is ultimately by Aslan's sacrifice. He dies on the stone table and he comes back to life. And that's the way that he defeats the witch's hold over Edmund. And that's a very obvious retelling, a reimagining, if you like, of the gospel story of Christ's sacrifice on Calvary. The interesting thing, though, is that when you begin to look at Lewis's understanding of Jupiter, you find that Jupiter was also associated in his mind with the sacrifice of Christ on the cross. In 1948, which was the same year that Lewis began writing The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe in earnest, Lewis also published a book about the poetry of his great friend Charles Williams. Williams was another member of the Inklings and a huge influence on Lewis. And in this book, Lewis points out how Williams, in one of his poems, talks about Jupiter's red pierced planet. And then Lewis adds and says, when he writes about Jupiter's red pierced planet, Williams assumes that the huge reddish spot which astronomers observe on the surface of Jupiter is a wound, and the redness is that of blood. Jupiter, the planet of kingship, thus wounded, becomes another ectype, that is to say another symbol, of the divine king wounded on Calvary. That's in Williams's own poetry, and that shows you that Lewis had reason very explicitly to connect jovial symbolism, Jupiter symbolism, with the sacrifice of Christ on the cross. So when he reworks that sacrifice at the heart of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, it's another manifestation of kingship, of true kingship, which bleeds and suffers for its subjects. It doesn't lord it over its subjects. It leads by service.
So one of the things that we can think about as we're reading the Chronicles is, in a sense, what's the point of all of this use of the planetary imagery? And it's not simply that Lewis thought it would simply be fun, although I'm sure it was enjoyable to play around with that, but rather it brings us into the experience of experiencing a world in which these things are true, in which we experienced joviality, for instance. And in the Narnia Code, you make a connection between that and the experience of knowing God.
Yes, absolutely. The children in the story, they see Aslan, and they see that he's kingly. In The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, he's described as royal. He's got a royal standard, a royal pavilion, great royal head. He's the king of the wood. That's the very first description they're given of him. He's the king of the beasts. He isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king. So his kingship is constantly emphasized. But as they get to know him and live with him and follow him, the interesting thing is that the children themselves become kings and queens. And that's, I think, one of Lewis's most interesting theological points, and one of the main purposes for which he uses this planetary symbolism, that it controls the way he portrays Aslan, but it also controls the way that the children develop within each story. They take on Aslan's character and properties in each story. As they live in this atmosphere and breathe it in, they begin to become more like Aslan. They become Christ-like. So what he does with the jovial symbolism in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, he does with the martial symbolism in Prince Caspian. Prince Caspian is written to embody and express the characteristics of Mars, and it's that which we'll be looking at in the next episode.
And of course, there's actually more material that you cover in this fourth chapter in the Narnia Code, and then in Planet Narnia, you go into even more details. Just a couple of points for the listeners to be aware of is, in this chapter, in at least the Narnia Code, you do bring back in as to how Father Christmas ties in and why it was important for him to include, and then you note about the music of Jupiter, among other things. Welcome back to another podcast in a series taking a chapter-by-chapter look at the Narnia Code. I'm William O'Flaherty, and with me, as before, is Dr. Holly Ordway. Today, the topic is the fifth chapter of the book. It's called The Wooden Shield of Mars, and it deals with Prince Caspian. As noted in the last episode, to gain the most meaning from what we're talking about, it's important to have heard at least the first three shows because it lays the foundation to understanding Dr. Ward's perspective and how the planets tie in. So be sure and listen to those if you haven't already. And, of course, the last episode kicked us off with the planet-by-planet that we're doing right now. Michael, you made a connection in this chapter in the Narnia Code. You start out by noting how Star Wars and C.S. Lewis are related. How are they related?
Well, very indirectly, but the soundtrack to the film Star Wars, which was written by John Williams, is full of military-sounding music, as is appropriate for a film called Star Wars. You know, it's got a blaring brass section, it's got deafening drums and an ominous beat. And John Williams based that music very obviously on the music of Gustav Holst, who wrote a marvelous suite of movements called the Planet Suite. And in that suite, he has a whole movement devoted to Mars, which is very, very similar to what John Williams would later do in Star Wars. And C.S. Lewis listened to Gustav Holst's Planet Suite on a number of occasions and talks about how the Mars movement was brilliant. Brutal and ferocious is how Lewis described it.
So Prince Caspian is full of the themes of Mars, the god of war, and it may seem strange to modern readers that Lewis would be, in a sense, what seems like glorifying war, and especially for a writer who came out of experiences in World War I. Now, in Planet Narnia, you noted that Lewis saw that there were three different kinds of writing about war, which he called the enchanted, the disenchanted, and then the re-enchanted, with varying responses to the experience of war, over-romanticizing it, but then also just seeing only the degradation horror of it. And he talks about re-enchanting it. So how does this shape his handling of those themes in Prince Caspian? It was significant to Lewis writing when he did after the wars, after World War II, but also, I think, significant for readers today in an era after even more wars.
Well, you're right. For Lewis, there was a proper use for warfare and a proper spirit in which war should be engaged or undertaken if it had to be so. And the symbolism of Mars for Lewis was a very useful way of talking about these different qualities. So in Prince Caspian, the second of the Narnia Chronicles, you've got, in a way, you've got three approaches to warfare. You've got the brutal and ferocious, excessively violent and cruel approach, which is exemplified by the hag and the werewolf and by Nicabric. They're prepared to do anything necessary in order to win the war, to cast out the evil, usurping King Miraz. And that's obviously unacceptable. That is not the sort of martial spirit that Lewis is advocating at all. But on the other hand, you've got the Telmarines, who are also insufficiently or improperly martial. They are rather dandified. You remember how the Telmarine lords, Glozell and Soapspion, swan around in a rather dandified fashion, talking in rather affected tones about their dappled pomelies. And they're rather like the French court in Shakespeare's Henry V. They're not sufficiently disciplined. They're not sufficiently manly. They are effeminate warriors. They are not truly, they don't have enough backbone in them. And that's no better. Because warfare, if it has to be undertaken, does require a certain amount of strength and hardihood or hardiness. Now, in between these two extremes, you have the Narnians, summed up particularly in the character of Peter, who is the model knight. He is disciplined. He's able to give and to receive orders. He's very chivalrous and gallant. He's not afraid to be sensitive and gentle when necessary. You know, he kisses the furry head of the badger, for instance. He takes great pains to be diplomatic with Reaperchief and the bulgy bears. But he's also strong enough to wallop off the head of Soapspear and then cut his legs from under him with the backswing of the same stroke. And that's to show that he is both fierce to the nth degree and gentle to the nth degree. And that's how Lewis wrote about the true spirit of Mars in a very interesting little piece he wrote during the Second World War called The Necessity of Chivalry. We need chivalrous knights who will save us from, on the one hand, wolves who cannot understand, and on the other hand, sheep who cannot defend all that makes life desirable.
In fact, I did an essay chat on the on that essay with Kevin Belmonte about the necessity of chivalry. That's a very good essay by Lewis.
It would be interesting for listeners, which is the connection between Mars as a god of war is reasonably well known culturally, but the connection between him and trees is not as well known, but it's where we get the name of the month, March, spring month, etc. And this is something that comes up thematically to a great degree in Prince Caspian.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, as you say, everybody generally knows that Mars is the god of war. Hardly anybody knows, I certainly didn't know before I began researching this, that Mars was originally not the god of war, but he was a vegetation deity. He was associated with trees and forests. And as you say, he was known as Mars Silvanus in that capacity. And that's why the month of March, when the trees come back to life after winter, is sacred to Mars and is called March. And that's why there are all these tree characters in Prince Caspian, including Sylvans. Sylvans only ever appear in Prince Caspian. Under that name, and it's in Aslan's presence that the trees come to life. Lucy tries to wake the trees, but cannot, unless Aslan is present. So Aslan, in his own person, sums up the twin aspects of Mars. He can wake the trees, because he's the true Mars Silvanus, as it were, but he's also the one who gives the great war cry in that chapter called The Lion Roars, which summons everyone to the final battle. So what we see Lewis doing in Prince Caspian with the martial symbolism is he's turning it to Christian effect. He's showing how this spirit of martial discipline, which is abroad in the rest of the tale, comes to its kind of consummation, its concentration. You might almost say its incarnation in the person of Aslan. He's the martial spirit made flesh, as it were. Like Jesus is the Word made flesh. And that, I think, again, is one of the important and interesting theological purposes that Lewis has in mind for this planetary symbolism. He's wanting to take each planetary symbol and use it to bring out a different aspect of God's nature. Because repeatedly in the Bible, God is described in military terms, isn't he? He's the Lord of hosts, mighty in battle. And in the New Testament, we are instructed to put on the whole armour of God, to be faithful soldiers of Christ, and above all, to take the shield of faith. That's why I think Lewis makes such play with the shield in Peter's single combat with Miraz. So some people get a little bit nervous about when they hear that Lewis was using pagan gods and goddesses, but as far as Lewis was concerned, you could use anything, really, and baptize it. That's the key word, baptize it, wash it and clean it of its unhelpful associations. But then, once it was baptized, put it to Christian effect, and that's precisely what he does in the Narnia Chronicles.
In fact, I think we see an example of that, don't we, in Bacchus, because there's that telling comment by Lucy who says, if Aslan, if you weren't here, I think I would be a bit nervous around him.
That's right.
But, in fact, he is there, and he becomes part of the celebration.
Absolutely, yes. The true Bacchus, as it were, the true spirit of revelry and happiness is personified in this character Bacchus, and because he is there in the presence of Aslan, it's all okay. So here again, you know, Lewis is, as it were, giving us scriptural material. You know, wine maketh glad the heart of God and man, take a little wine for thy stomach's sake, and so on and so forth, that we find in the Bible, and he's giving it a very memorable demonstration through this character Bacchus.
Now, of course, this book is called Prince Caspian, and he develops to an extent in terms of his knightness and such. What did you notice when you were doing your research and that you described here in the Narnia Code?
Well, one thing that is particularly memorable about Prince Caspian is when he witnesses the constellation, with the conjunction of two stars in the heavens. Dr. Cornelius takes him up the tower and points out to him the conjunction of Tava, the Lord of Victory, and Alambil, the Lady of Peace. And their conjunction, Dr. Cornelius says, betokens some great good for the sad realm of Narnia. And so that's another indication of the importance of planetary symbolism in the Narnia Chronicles. Here it's explicit. It's explicitly foregrounded in the plot. But the point I'm trying to argue is that it's there in the background and informing the whole hard wiring of the plot and the portrayals and the ornamental details as well, implicitly, not always explicitly. So, for instance, when Caspian, later in the story, sleeps under the stars, as we're told, we're told that he began to harden. And likewise, Edmund, when he begins to breathe the air of Narnia in this book, all his old battles come back to him. And when Susan rediscovers her bow and arrow in the treasure chamber, she finds that the bowstring on her bow has not perished. Some magic in the air has saved it from perishing. And it's all these little points that I think are implicit ways in which Lewis conveys this martial spirit. He's indicating that the very air of Narnia is infused, as it were, with a martial spirit. And if you breathe it, if you sleep under the stars, you will become truly martial. That is, if your spirit is aligned properly with Aslan. As I've already pointed out, there are hags and werewolves and there are the Telmarines who are not properly aligned with Aslan, and so their martial character becomes perverted or distorted in various ways.
So one of the references that Lewis, I think, is picking up in Prince Caspian is this idea of Isaiah and the trees clapping their hands and singing for joy, is we get the trees coming alive. Hmm. And so that seems to be part of how he's drawing us also into this experience of knowing God, somewhat as he did with the kingly atmosphere of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Hmm.
That's right, yes. The martial spirit is present not just in the warrior or the military themes of the book, but also in the woodland imagery. And as you say, if we're looking for scriptural sources to these sorts of ideas, then that verse from Isaiah is very good. The trees of the field shall clap their hands. Absolutely. So one shouldn't feel any kind of hesitation about the thing that Lewis is doing here. It's all perfectly scriptural. It's just that because he knows a great deal more literature than just the Bible, he's able to draw upon his great familiarity with Greek and Roman and Norse and even Egyptian mythology, and tease out of these mythologies strains and strands which are to be put to good use in the very artistic way in which he assembles this atmospheric quality based on the martial spirit.
In fact, you might say he's like the householder bringing out of his storehouse things
old and new. Yes, absolutely.
All right, well, I wish there was more time to discuss this and other points made in your book, The Narnia Code, as well as Planet Narnia, but time does not permit. The Voyage of the Dawn Treader is going to be the next episode. It's the next chapter, chapter 6 in your book. What are a couple of quick points our listeners can look forward to?
Gold, greed, and dragons.
Ah, all right. Well, with that, look forward to hearing what Dr. Ward has to say.
And so ends this second repackaged edition of the Narnia Code series. with Dr. Holly Ordway co-hosting, and Dr. Michael Ward being my guest. Originally, these were the fourth and fifth show. Next time, I'll share the sixth and seventh episodes. They deal with Voyage of the Dawn Treader and The Silver Chair, the third and fourth books published originally. I'm William O'Flaherty. Thank you for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm the creator of that website and the author of the forthcoming C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters, due out in March 2016. Learn more about it by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Be sure to check the show notes for links to the websites about Planet Narnia, the Narnia Code, and Dr. Ward's personal site. I also have links to other shows he has been on, which include an essay chat called Myth Became Fact. The show notes also include a link to Holly's personal site and the interview I did with her about her autobiography, Not God's Type, and two essay chats she did with me. You can find those show notes either by going to EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the audio files are hosted directly. Again, that's AllAboutJack.podbean.com. If you go to the other location, EssentialCSLewis.com, you can still get to this podcast. Plus, I have a variety of articles there as well, including a series examining quotations alleged to be from C.S. Lewis. I hope you enjoyed today's show enough to want to share it. Also, feel free to leave comments about the program online and consider listening to other shows. The last two new shows I did was first about the Journal of Inkling Studies, and then most recently about attending a Inklings Week in Oxford with several Lewis scholars, as well as a special episode dealing with the lost recording from C.S. Lewis that was recently discovered. Again, you can hear my podcast by either going to EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. If you have questions or comments, email them to info@EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, that's info@EssentialCSLewis.com. Finally, did you know that you can help make this podcast freely available to others? Consider becoming a financial sponsor of this podcast to make sure it continues. There's a link in the show notes about this. Contributions can be as little as a dollar a month. There are some great rewards possible, and it is not necessary to make a long-term commitment.